You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, February 20th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Elaine Olin, author of Exposing the Dark Side of Personal Finance, Pound Foolish. Also on the program today, the origins of the Friends of Hamas story that has been dogging Defense Secretary nominee Chuck Hagel. Just a wonderful, heartwarming story of how a right-winger congressional staffer and the morons that they talk to can spread a complete fiction. Also on the program today, dogs may be your best friends, but can you trust them beyond any other source of suspicion? Yes, says the Supreme Court. New figures on how many jobs are going to come from Keystone. Stated 200 permanent jobs in the past. It turns out it's probably closer to 15. And in Greece, massive strikes across the country to protest austerity. Perfectly timed for, well, our own bout of austerity, which should be coming in about a week or so. As we rush headlong into the sequester. The sequester, of course, which has emanated out of the foolishness of both parties and, frankly, the adoption by President Obama in 2011 or 2010 of the sort of austerity rhetoric. At the time, we were all told this is a genius move. This is why he didn't capitulate on the debt ceiling. It was a genius move. Well, turns out not so genius, but hopefully this will be a teachable moment, I guess, as many millions of people suffer for absolutely no reason whatsoever. That's always cheery. And also, I should say, if you're feeling a little down the dumps, relief could be coming. Apparently, as the Higgs boson studies continue, they found the Higgs, I guess. And it turns out maybe the universe is going to turn inside itself. It's probably going to happen a billion years from now. So hopefully a few of us will be around to see that. But your great, 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 times probably 100 or 200 or 300 or a million.
Well, I'm planning to be around then.
Yes, I know. You have a lot of longevity, Matt. Let's get to this story before we talk to Elaine Olin. You are familiar with Angelo Carusone. He is the guy behind the dump rush. Essentially the online campaign to get advertisers to stop funding Rush Limbaugh's circus of hate and ridiculousness. He was wildly successful. Limbaugh still hurting in terms of advertisers. Well, some time ago, he started Dump Trump. Donald Trump being a spokesperson, or at least has a line of, I don't know what it is, putrid-smelling cologne or something for Macy's. And he's been at least somewhat successful if Donald Trump's reaction is any barometer. Apparently, Trump attorney Alan Garten has sent a cease and desist letter to Angelo Carusone and threatened to seek damages of not less than $25 million if the protest continues. You know that Donald Trump is a huge advocate of the First Amendment. And while he's not going out and doing investigative reporting on people's birth certificates, apparently Trump is getting a little worried that his relationship with Macy's is in jeopardy. Trump's lawyer released Carusone released the threatening letter. And Trump's lawyer says the guy's desperate for media attention. The guy's a loser. Now, to be honest, I don't know, because I'm not seeing this. I got this story from Daily Kos. I'm not seeing the quote in context. So I don't know if Trump's lawyer isn't just talking about his client, Donald Trump, when he says the guy's desperate for media attention, the guy's a loser. But however, if he's not, he is a ninja in the fine art of projection. And so head over to majority.fm. We've put a link up to the petition. It's obviously working. And make sure you add your name to that long roster of signatures. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Helene Olin. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, Helene Olin. Welcome to the program, Helene. Hello? Oh, sorry. Hi, hold on for 1 second. There we go. Helene, thank you for joining us.
Hi, good afternoon.
Really enjoyed your book. And in fact, I'm sitting here, I was motivated to buy Personal Finance for Dummies. Now, we're not going to get into too much of my personal finance illiteracy, but I have to cop to being a fan of AM Talk Radio. And I have listened to my fair share of Dave Ramsey and
right.
have entered into my home and said to my wife, rice and beans, sweetie, we could do this. If we can save our way out of our financial issues, and we can become clean and moral people. If only we can save our money and get out of debt. So it was a bit of a relief to realize that that instinct was a little bit unfounded. But let's start with tell us the history of the personal finance industry, which you really take apart here. And we should say that at one point you were part of this this industry as well.
Right. Right. Should I start with my personal story here?
Yeah. Why don't you? And then let's head backwards.
Okay. I got a call one day in 1996 asking me if I knew anything about personal finance from a major newspaper and if I could cover it. And the one thing I knew about personal finance writing was that it paid a heck of a lot more than other journalism. So, of course, I said, yeah.
Well, that was your first indication that you knew something about personal finance.
Right. And apparently that was enough. So I take the assignment, and I think this is going to end badly. But instead I get another one and another one, and pretty soon I'm a personal finance writer. So I learned two things from this. The first is that this is actually not that hard on one level, right? All these terms that sound mysterious, like mutual fund, like, because I didn't know a mutual fund from Mutual of Omaha when I took this gig, are actually pretty easy concepts to understand. On the other hand, of course, nobody knows anything about any of this stuff. We don't know how the stock market's going to do next week or next year or 5 years out. We don't know if we're going to keep our jobs. We don't know if, you know, our salaries are going to go up or down. We really have no idea. So there's kind of a contradiction here. We're planning for the unknowable.
And so, okay, so let's go back. I mean, let's talk about how this industry, the roots of this industry, because in many respects, I think it speaks to the popularity of the industry in some way, that it does strike a chord, or at least it fulfills some type of need that we all have, this sense that we have the ability to sort of control our own destiny in some type of mystical way.
Right. It starts, and this shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody, during the Great Depression, when a woman named Sylvia Porter started writing about these issues in the hopes of educating Americans so that the Great Depression would never happen again. And it sort of becomes bigger and bigger as time goes on, because people come back from World War II, we suddenly have more money, and there's nobody else writing about this stuff but Sylvia Porter.
And she had millions... I mean, she had millions and millions of readers.
Millions and millions of readers, because if you wanted money advice, there was nothing else out there for many years. But when it really becomes big is it starts in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And a couple of things are going on at that point. First, of course, the economy isn't so great. Second, this is when income inequality starts to open up. We start having a harder time getting ahead. And the third thing that goes on is suddenly the Reagan Revolution happens, and we're responsible for more and more things. Corporate pensions begin to go away. We have to save for our own retirements. And we need help. And so we turn to this personal finance industry to tell us how to get by. Every year, as we're struggling to keep up, we need to do more and more. And this industry is out there saying, we have the answers. We're going to help you.
I mean, it's fascinating because it seems to me that in some ways, I mean, the parallel I see is the rise in the popularity and the demand for this type of you know, whether it's you talk about rich dad, poor dad, or, you know, these sort of formulas in which we can make money is almost sort of the equivalent of the way that people turn to sort of fundamental religion in some ways as dealing with modernity, because it seems to me that finance became far more complicated in the 70s and 80s. That
right.
Simultaneously, talk about that a little bit. Talk about the rise of things like a 401k, because we've seen just literally in the past week or two, a series of stories about the failure of 401ks in private pensions, and the failure of defined contribution pensions versus defined benefit pensions in providing the baby boomers for a decent retirement. And this is all, of course, happening with the backdrop of the potentiality of cutting Social Security benefits. So, I mean, talk about what was happening in those years, and particularly where the story of 401ks.
Okay. 401ks are a great historic accident. They start as a tax dodge by a number of corporate executives looking to put more of their salary aside without paying taxes. Something that should be all very familiar to us today. And instead, what happens is an enterprising attorney named Ted Benna gets the Reagan administration to agree that all of us could do this, not just a couple of high-paid executives. And the next thing we know is the corporate bean counters step in, and they quickly realize, hey, wait a minute. If we can get people to put their salary aside for, without paying taxes for a while, we don't have to offer pensions. So they start taking away our pensions. So all of a sudden, we go from this world where, you know, we worked for 30 years and we retired with a pension to this world where we needed to put our own salary aside, put it in the stock market, hope the stock market kept up, hope we didn't need to withdraw that money in case we were unemployed or had a health care crisis or needed to buy our children that college education, and assume it was all going to work out. As, of course, we all know, it didn't work out. The vast majority of people now have less than $100,000 saved for retirement. This is not a sum of money that's going to get anyone very far in retirement. Think about it, $100,000 divided by 20 years, say, 30 if you're lucky. And on top of that, we're estimating that people are going to need $240,000, a couple retiring last year, that is, for health care expenses. Well, if they don't have that, what are they going to do? And this is the kind of the roots of the crisis we're now facing.
I mean, it seems to me that that it was all sort of a function of this desire to essentially privatize. I mean, these go hand in hand. I mean, when we're talking about the sort of the rise of the 401k, I mean, it's a perfect mechanism in which to sort of continually put more of the burden on individuals and basically, go out and just, we had learned the lesson that the development of Social Security was a function of realizing that at the end of the day, society can provide for people's retirement better than individuals en masse can do. And this, it really seems that this, that now I don't know that, you know, the industry that the personal finance industry was pushing for this, but it certainly filled a gap that was opened up by this sort of broad move to privatize sort of this people's retirement and shift the risk to individuals as opposed to institutions being corporations or government. And it seems like this was sort of fruit laying on the ground that people could pick up and start to monetize in some way.
Right. I like to tell people we have this view of the past as this imagined happy time when, you know, grandparents lived with their children and, you know, we all took care of each other. In fact, Social Security was established because older people or children who lost a parent had this distressing tendency to end up in work.
Elaine?
Back then.
Go ahead.
Are you there?
Yes, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Should I start again?
Go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, but when the retirement plans started up, the financial services sector realized very quickly that this was a way to make an awful lot of money. As I always say, they earn hundreds of billions of dollars in profits a year off of our various retirement and savings and brokerage accounts. And as a result, they have hundreds of billions of reasons to sell you on their services. So we have an industry that presents itself as your financial savior in tough times, when in fact a good deal of their business model is actually involved in picking your pocket.
Yes, I mean, the amount of seminars. I mean, let's talk a little bit about some of the more popular ones, because Susie Orman, you really take to task in your book. And give me. I mean, I'm not as familiar with her, but I know part of her shtick is just basically scolding people. You can't afford this, and I guess if people need that type of advice, but it goes beyond that with her, doesn't it?
Yes. You know, all of these people, you know, I like to say they're sort of like, you know, we're the economic victims of a Hurricane Sandy. You know, we're hanging out on the Jersey Shore, and, you know, we need help. And they're saying, you know, oh, we have some umbrellas and sandbags, and this will protect you. And they forget to even mention that they're the ones selling you these umbrellas and sandbags that aren't going to protect you. So what Susie Orman is doing is she's on TV every week telling people, you know, hectoring people to save more money, weighing in on such life decisions as whether you should have a second child or not, which I would argue is goes way beyond personal finance, and, you know, selling us on your need for services. In fact, Susie Orman was not particularly financially successful before she had a was a financial guru. She's worth $30 billion. The vast majority of that money comes from her selling you her books, her tapes, her former stock market newsletter, her approved card, and I can go down the list. And the other thing she does, by the way, I should say, which I find hilarious, is she's the sort of financial equivalent of a cook who won't eat their own cooking. She's telling people they have so little money they need to invest in the stock market, but she won't invest in the stock market because she has $30 billion and she can afford to choose not to lose her money.
Yes, I mean, I guess it's an interesting sort of paradox there. I mean, and so basically you're saying that email that I received from that guy who says, I've made $2 million and finally I'm going to share with all of you so that you can all get rich, he's probably not on the up and up.
Well, what I always like to say is if somebody really had the secret as to what was going on in the stock market and how to pull this off, unless your last name is Buffett or Gates, why on earth are they telling you? Certainly they're going to make a lot more money setting up on a boat on the tax-free seas off the Cayman Islands and trading away an anonymous happiness. So by definition, you really have to start asking questions very early, Ed.
And let's, I mean, the what is the most egregious, I mean, would you say, I mean, because, you know, again, listening to a lot of AM talk radio, I hear ads for things like banking on yourself. And for the life of me, I can't quite figure out. I mean, I tried to go online and figure out what it is, but it's some type of like insurance scheme where you get annuities. I'm not quite sure I even understand the words that I just said. But what is the most sort of egregious of these sort of advice that people get?
There's so much out there, it's hard to know, to give you one answer. But the thing I've really singled in on right now is the free lunch and dinner circuit, which is if you're over 50, you start getting these invitations in the mail where they very much target a problem that, you know, we're all thinking about, like retirement, you know, getting by with less at old age, the government taking your money for taxes. Scare, and then they invite you to a free lunch or dinner, usually at a nice place like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, to hear about this, where you go, and at which point they scare you to death. I've been to several of these, and they tend to say things like, Social Security is going to get cut, your retirement benefits are going to be taxed, and otherwise scare you, and then offer your product, and annuities is a big one, by the way, as the solution. And these are, of course, high commission, high fee products that put an awful lot of money in the pockets of the person standing in front of you.
And so, I mean, the overall, the interesting thing about this is, it seems to me, is it creates this, and I think you refer to it as an illusion of control.
Right.
And
it allows you to think you're doing something. You know, it doesn't let you admit I have a problem. And maybe other people have a problem too. Instead, it's presented as everybody else is doing fine and you're not, but here's the way for you to do fine.
And I mean, talk about the implications of this, because it's not just a question, I think, in my mind, of individuals getting scammed, but it also serves to sort of continue and perpetuate this move to sort of privatize and undercut the ability of policy in society as a whole addressing these issues.
Right. Well, it turns what really is our collective finances. Most of us don't have enough money saved for retirement. You know, most of us don't, you know, 50% of us are living paycheck to paycheck with little or nothing in the way of savings. Most of us, you know, if we need to send a child to college, are looking at massive loans. You know, the average number right now is $27,000. And instead of saying, gosh, we all have a problem and we need to start working on this, it sort of makes what is a political problem personal and turns it into your personal financial problem. So we all think we're going down separately when, in fact, we're going down together, but we don't realize it. And the only group that's really making out from all of this, of course, is the financial services sector, which is collecting money every which way in dealing with this. From the student loans, from the fees on 401k retirement accounts, from the tapes and seminars they're selling you, from the product, financial products, they like to call them products, you're buying in an attempt to keep up with your rising living expenses.
Do you see a parallel? I mean, that sort of broad construction of these of issues, and whether it's, you know, I see it in the context of environmental issues. There was a big rise in the 90s of basically saying, like, we're going to deal with all these environmental issues by, you know, making sure that you separate your paper and your plastic in your home, taking these issues that at the end of the day, it's not a bad thing for individuals to, you know, not spend willy-nilly, but it's not a bad thing for people to recycle. But at the end of the day, these are all issues that really need to be addressed as a society through government policy. But in some way, there's been this sort of, I mean, I guess what has happened in terms of finance is also mirrored in other areas where it is this rise of individualism and a sort of a perception that society and government is a roadblock in some respects,
right,
rather than sort of the best way to address these issues.
Right. Academics actually have a term for this. They call it responsibilization. And the idea is that these are things we once expected the government to do for us, or the corporate sector, like pensions, like helping us out in old age, like making sure that college costs didn't go out of control by having affordable state universities, like having affordable health care with reasonable costs, and instead took away those protections or weakened them significantly and tossed it back on you, the individual. And I'd like to say, by the way, thank you for using the recycling example, because that's actually one of my personal favorites as well, is that we're all going to solve the environment by, you know, just sorting our papers and our plastic. And, of course, the corporations, which are responsible for the vast majority of pollution, just sort of go on and nobody says a word.
Yeah, I mean, what is the antidote to this? I mean, obviously, in the context of, well, I mean, let's start in terms of finance and broaden this out. I mean, what is the, you know, I mean, because, you know, there's this tension, you know, I used to have this argument all the time with my co-host, the question of how can these you know, these barons of industry continue to pollute? Don't they realize that their kids are going to be living in this planet as well? And my theory has always been they do realize that, and they think the best way to deal with sort of some type of massive crisis of civilization because of what they're doing to the environment is to stockpile as much money as possible so that their kids are living in the gated community or the floating bubble or living, you know, in a palace in Canada. I mean, so we have this tension where we want to deal with our own. We want to make sure that, you know, our own personal finances, the finances of our kids are in good shape. I mean, what should people be doing in terms of personal finance to the extent that there's anything they can do? And then let's talk about what's the antidote to the broader structural problem of this personalization.
Well, my first, you know, response has been is we need to start talking about it. We have this very powerful culture of shame around money in our country, which is why we were able in some ways to be sold all of this, because none of us are going to be failures, right? This is a country where we believe very deeply in the myth of Horatio Alger. Anybody can make it. Now, as I like to tell people, Horatio Alger was a writer of fiction. We live in a country with, you know, very limited social mobility, roughly the social mobility of like a second world country like Chile or Argentina. We, you know, Europe, which we think of as, you know, class bound and upstairs, downstairs, is actually way ahead of us. And I really began to feel the first thing we needed to do was simply acknowledge what was going on. And I always felt, I should add, that that was kind of the genius of Occupy, that they were the first movement, and I like to say this to people who I know don't like Occupy as well, I'm assuming most of the audience on this show likes it, but they were the first movement in maybe 30 or 40 years that where somebody finally made the intuitive leap and said, gosh, you're going bankrupt from medical debt, your house was just foreclosed on, your student loans are unreal and you can't get a job. Maybe we all have a problem here and we need to start discussing it. And I think that is actually the first step we can take collectively to begin to get somewhere. The more we all realize we're in it together, the more our institutions will begin to respond to us and change.
I mean, to what extent do you think, I mean, because, you know, my sense is that when I listen to these guys, like Dave Ramsey in particular, but even this past weekend, I couldn't help myself, and a local financial investment guy was dipping into politics and talking about how, you know, entitlements are out of control and we need to balance the budget and, you know, the sort of the classic fix the debt type of mentality. But he's just a local guy in Albany offering an opportunity to invest with him. I couldn't help it but call in. But it does seem that these finance, personal finance gurus, all share that sort of same political ideology that in some ways perpetuates the need for their product. How conscious do you think they are of that? Or is it simply that's, you know, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail?
I think all of the above. You know, I think a lot of these people do come from a fairly conservative place, first of all. Second, you know, in terms of the talk about entitlements, you know, this has been a 20-year barrage at this point, you know, of nonstop, you know, I hate to use the word, but almost like literally propaganda that our problem is Social Security. Now, of course, you know, you and I know that there's a very easy way to solve the Social Security problem. That would be to take off the pay cap and start taxing benefits over $113,000. But in fact, that doesn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen is because the people who are controlling this debate are the people who are often earning that amount of money and more, and really aren't very interested in paying taxes on it.
And so, I mean, what is the antidote? I mean, to this in a broader sense. I mean, obviously, you've talked about you know, you're writing this book, and that is it is to get, you know, sort of to make people take that turn. And I've always contemplated in the past. I mean, for years, back in the days of Air America, I was saying that we should come up with a finance show that contextualizes people's problems in the context of what is happening in society and governmental policy. But it's tough to sort of come up with what the third episode of that is.
Right.
You know, once you say those things that like, hey, look, we're all dealing with this. Where do you go from there?
Right. I mean, I've said any number of things because it does feel really like almost like a knot right now that you can't break. But there's a lot of different parts of it. And as I said, the first part is talking about it. The second part is getting people to mobilize. You know, it is very interesting that every time the concept of chain CPI, the cut in Social Security benefits, comes up, people who would be affected actually appear to be very concerned about this and start calling their congresspeople and push back very hard. And so far, it hasn't happened. Obviously, people need to keep doing that. The third part, you know, is stuff like campaign finance reform. You know, one of the issues in the personal finance sector is this idea that the vast majority of financial salespeople, we think they need to act in our financial best interests. In fact, they have no such duty to us. They only sort of have to kind of act in our best interests, the thing called the suitability standard. And, you know, the Obama administration has for years, through the Department of Labor and through the SEC, been trying to get a handle on this and impose what is called the fiduciary standard, which is the idea that people who are selling financial products have to always act in our best interests to do just that. And every time this comes up, the pushback is enormous from people in Congress and other lobbyists. And, of course, when you look at the you know, their fundraising records, the pushback often comes from people who are getting a lot of money from the financial services sector. So that's a huge part of the problem, too. And just to go on, why this is such a huge problem, a bunch of professors at Harvard a couple of years ago set up a study where they hired a bunch of actors to go in, gave them, you know, fake portfolios, sent them into banks and brokerages, and said, what would you do with this? And over again, they were, you know, told they should invest in, make changes they didn't need to make, you know, buy products they didn't need, buy high-fee managed mutual funds when a low-cost index fund would have been best, and so on down the line. But the best part of the study comes when these actors go back to the researchers at Harvard, and not only didn't they realize they'd gotten bad advice, they actually said more than two-thirds of them said they would go back. They thought these brokers were so amazing. They would make plans to go back to them with their real portfolios.
The actors themselves, knowing that they were part of the study, even when, oh my God.
Yeah, even they fell for it, which you know, it shows you how persuasive this stuff can be and why we so desperately need to be protected from a lot of it.
Is it a function of how persuasive it is, or is it a function of how just overwhelmed people are in terms of both the complications of our financial lives now and the fact that in some ways it's just so opaque. I mean, I certainly feel that way myself personally, that, you know, I really, and it's sort of just easier for me to just sort of say like, I'll just let, you know, we'll see, everything will work out.
Right. It's a combination of all of the above. People are, you know, don't know much about this. It is made deliberately opaque by the financial services industry because, of course, that's how they make their money, is by people not knowing much about this. People are busy. They don't have time to, you know, go read Personal Finance for Dummies, you know, constantly and over again. The nature of what you're investing in changes constantly. I mean, 10 years ago, who heard of an ETF, right?
Right.
And then finally, people are scared and desperate. And these salespeople, these brokers, these advisors, whatever you want to call them, are very much trained to be persuasive. I mean, they do come across as your best friend, and they do come across as somebody who wants to help you.
So lastly, let me ask you this. I mean, this is a little bit off topic, but I wonder if, you know, your thoughts on it, because you've been obviously thinking about the sort of the this relationship that people have to government in terms of its capacity to sort of, execute broad policy that will affect their lives in some ways, because that's really, it seems to me, in many respects, what at the end of the day, much of this is about. But the sequester seems to be all but inevitable at this point. And there, in my estimation, my sense is better the sequester, and it's sad that we only have these two options that were on the table, better the sequester than some type of cuts, future cuts in Medicare by raising the eligibility age, or cuts in Social Security by calculating a cost of living increase, which actually diminishes, underreports the cost of living for seniors.
Right.
Do you think that there is any chance that in the event the sequester hits, that people start to make this connection between broad government policy and actually how it impacts their daily lives? Because we're going to see a diminishment of services in some level. I mean,
I do think so. And I'm old enough to remember what happened when Newt Gingrich shut down the federal government in 1995. And people made the connection pretty darn quick then, too. I actually think people have made the connection. I don't think very many people want to see these services get cut. I would argue we're being held up at this point. And, you know, this has almost become, I don't want to say it's quite a Scylla and Charybdis-like choice, because I essentially agree with you, better a short-term cut, you know, sequester cut, than a long-term, full-on, you know, chain CPI for Social Security and massive cuts to, you know, government social safety programs. But I do think people do see this, and I think, you know, people feel very powerless right now, and which is why I just say we need to begin to talk about this and begin to really, you know, call your congressman. I mean, I know that sounds terribly old-fashioned, right? But that's what they told you in school. If you don't do it, no one's hearing you.
And also, you can it's a great opportunity to go and flip houses now, right, with the low mortgage rates?
But, hey, if you can get a mortgage, which is the problem right now, right? Is there's all these great mortgage rates out there, but good luck to you trying to get a hold of one.
Indeed.
But of course, if you listen to Robert Kiyosaki, you could just do it on your credit card.
That's the rich dad, poor dad thing.
That's rich dad, poor dad. That was one of his. I mean, he doesn't actually say it himself, but if you pay the several hundred dollars to go to his seminars, that's among the advice they give you, is to get your credit limit raised so that you have money on hand for a good investment. And not surprisingly, I interviewed people for my book who had done exactly that, had bought houses with money, with down payments raised from their credit card. You know, hey, why not pay 30% interest, right?
Right, indeed. Well, Helene Olin, the book is Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of Personal Finance. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We have a link up to your book at majority.fm.
Thank you.
All right, folks. And now it is time for us to... It comes up quick, doesn't it?
It's insane. It's insane how quick this better half of the show comes up.
'Cause
that was a great interview.
There you go, folks. I'm literally sitting here right now with my personal finance for dummies. Because Nick and I are in a, you know, a semi-panic. Last night, we had the we were both dumbstruck by realizing that the expiration date on our milk in the refrigerator actually will kick in after our child is born. And I tweeted that last night. A lot of people thought I was worried about the milk. Didn't quite. Coming up in the better half of the program, I will play that clip where I was compelled to call in to this guy's radio show. It's not barn burner, but it's, I don't know, it's somewhat interesting anyways. And also, it's also interesting just at what point he muted my phone and then subsequently hung up on me as if I was still on the line talking to me. Also in the better half, we got a clip that David Sirota had tweeted out when he made an appearance on CNN to talk about the issue of how much money is waiting for you after you leave government, particularly in the case of Hillary Clinton. But it's not that part of the story that is so astonishing about this clip. You will enjoy it, I am sure. Also, in the better half, more on how the Friends of Hamas meme. I don't know if it's a meme or another example of how moronic the right wing media is. I mean, just stunning. We'll talk about that as well and more. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Folks, let me say this about these personal finance stuff. Look, I have a wonderful opportunity for you where you can, for as little as 33 cents a day, you can actually have delivered to your computer or to your mobile phone or any type of listening device a full, at least 90 minutes of audio programming a day. And you will not only will you receive 90 minutes of audio programming a day worth far more than 33 cents, you will also be supporting the first free 40 minutes that you receive every day now. This is a wonderful opportunity for you, and now is the time. Take control of your life. For 33 cents a day, you can become a member of the Majority Report by going to majority.fm, clicking on Become a Member, Become a Member. You will not only receive that 90 minutes, but today, and actually tomorrow and probably for an extended period of time, you will also receive, if you want, a couple of my near-famous comedy DVDs. Which are available at member benefits at the majority.fm site. What else do you get for 33 cents, Matt?
You get, I don't know, what do you want me to say? No, I think you pretty much covered it.
You get some stock tips in the email. It's a secret occasionally, majority.
Yeah.
I think the point of this is really that, folks, we need your money because, as you can tell, Sam is very, very worried that his milk has almost expired.
Indeed.
Sam was trying to get me to invest in a condo scheme with him in Florida last week.
Yeah.
That's where we're at.
Yeah. My condo scheme went awry. All right, folks. Become a member today. You can also support this show by clicking on our Amazon link at majority.fm/support-the-show. Bookmarking it. Buy all your junk through Amazon that you happen to buy through Amazon. You will see absolutely no difference. But we will get a little bit of a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority FM blend. I have never heard anyone, and we've been they have been our longest sponsor. I have never received an email telling me that they regret buying that coffee. It's great coffee. And you can take the money that you save from going and spending whatever it is, $8 for a latte. And whatever. I don't know how much lattes are going for these days. And build your personal fortune that way. All right, folks. I'll see you in the better half. 646-257-3920. I am turning on my IM as we speak. You can IM me at Majority FM. Any of our legacy accounts, majority.fm at jabber.org. If you're coming through Gmail, I guess. What else?
You can subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Yeah, subscribe to our YouTube channel.
You can donate your account.
Donate your account at donateyouraccount.com.
In fact, I forgot to mention this. If you donated your Facebook account previously, Facebook had changed their like API, their back-end stuff. So when Kyle had to remake the Donate Your Account to match up with Facebook's new API, some of you may have dropped out of the Donate Your Account because our Facebook donation numbers are way down. So if you previously donated your account, your Facebook account, go back to Donate Your Account and just make sure you're still donating it.
Oh, well, I didn't know that. It's something you should have told me.
Well, it's just something I recently discovered.
All right. There you go, folks. All right. See you in the better half.